All right, please take your Bibles and turn to Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. This is how our Bibles begin, and this lays the foundation for the creation week. As we have stressed, and as Exodus 20, verse 11 makes clear, the creation of the heaven, the earth, and the seas was indeed a part of those 6 days of creation, meaning that the elements that were created on day one were the heaven, the earth, the seas, and light. Now, we focused upon the creation of heaven and earth in the beginning, that very first message, as we talked about the advent of space, of time, and of matter. Then last time we were together, we considered the creation of light. Last week we had a missionary, so it was 2 weeks ago. But we were considering the creation of light. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And verse 4 tells us God saw the light, that it was good. And I shared my conviction in that message that what this event is depicting is actually not so much about the visible UV spectrum or any of those things, but rather first the angelic beings as those who are the morning stars, creatures of light. And then second, a definitive measure for time, as he called the light day and he called the darkness night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. And so we see day and night. And then this 24-hour period of time that is designated as a day, we'll see more designations of time in our time together today. And then finally, and I would say most importantly, and I think this is actually what the scripture is getting at, when we compare Genesis 1 with John 1, we see that God established in this time the moral universe, that he established the moral laws by which the universe would be governed. And today we continue through the rest of the creation week. I promise you we would not do one verse for 1 week or 1 week for one verse in perpetuity. We're covering some ground today, and hopefully we'll be able to continue to cover some ground and not get too bogged down. And we cover today days 2 through most of day 6. And I say most of day 6 because we are going to stop short of talking about the creation of man. There's enough to do there that'll be next time that we're together. There's enough to do that we're not going to try to fit man into the week with everyone else and consider him. There's a lot to think of there. But we pick up in day 2 in verses 6 through 8. The Bible says this in Genesis chapter 1. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. Now, as we get into the second day of creation, like day one in many ways, there is no small amount of debate about this particular verse and what is being said here. But there is a big difference between this. And it is that as in day one, this debate about what light is, I attributed to a theological issue. The fact that I believe that it was speaking of a John 1 concept of the moral universe being created. In the second day, day 2, verses 6 through 8, this is significantly more of a science issue, a kind of a historical science or natural science issue. And this is not a science lecture. This is a sermon. So I'm not going to spend an entire sermon talking about what could be here. That being said, we are going to talk through it a little bit, and I'm going to try to help us think through this from a biblical standpoint. So before the second day, the earth was nothing but sea, as we would expect it. He made the heaven, the earth, and the sea. That's what Exodus 20, verse 11 told us. The initial formless and void state of the earth was a ball that was covered in, as we would expect, nothing but water. But beyond that, we don't see anything just yet. We see water. And the will of the Father was that the waters which were upon the earth would be divided, and between water and water there would be a firmament being an open space or a period of space, a firmament put between water and water. And this has all the marks of being something very confusing and very controversial, right? because we have water on the earth, but we don't have water in the sky per se. Now, there are elements of water in the sky. We know that rain comes from clouds that are in the sky. Is that what we're talking about here? Are we talking about something that was specifically pre-flood, what we call pre-diluvian? Now it's no longer there because the flood changed things so much. Or is it something else entirely? And before we can begin to chisel away at this thoughtfully, we need to define our terms. And specifically, we need to establish what it is relative to our observable universe that is being called heaven here. And then we can talk about the water. So there was a firmament created, which was called heaven. This word firmament, I already said that that word firmament in the Hebrew it speaks of, and then in our Webster's 1828, it would be defined as open space or a space between. And it's used 15 times in the Old Testament, 7 times in Genesis, 2 in the Psalms, 5 in Ezekiel, and once in Daniel. But their occurrences don't give us a whole lot of help in determining what's going on here. Much more helpful is the direct evidence or the direct context that we find here in Genesis chapter 1. So here in verses 6 through 8, the Bible tells us that God called, verse 8 specifically, God called the firmament heaven. All right, so this space that God made, he called heaven. And that gives us insight into what the Bible is speaking about. Now, I'm not going to get into today the classification as we continue through the Bible of the different heavens. There are typically three things that the Bible speaks of when it speaks of heaven. It speaks of our atmosphere. It speaks of what we call outer space. And it speaks of the abode of God. All three of those are called heaven. In this case, the heaven being spoken of here, that which is being defined as heaven, is a place between the waters of the earth and the waters above the earth. So this is what we've got so far. We've got the waters on the earth. We've got the waters above the earth. We've got a space between, and that space is called heaven. Now, let's gain our bearings before we get into a little bit more about heaven. Let's gain our bearings based upon the universe as we understand it from an observable, testable, repeatable framework as to what we see in relative to our universe. As we view the world from the culmination of human knowledge throughout the advent of technologies which have allowed us to look further into the created universe, we know that the earth has an atmosphere. And that atmosphere is made up effectively of four layers. We have the troposphere, and that's from the Earth's surface going up to about 6 miles above the Earth's surface. This is where weather happens. This is where almost all clouds exist. This is where the majority of airplanes fly right at the top of the troposphere. Some get into the stratosphere. But that's the troposphere. Then we have the stratosphere. And that's from about that 6 mile point up to about 31 miles. This is where the ozone exists. This is where that ozone converts UV light into heat and we get the heating of the earth. Then we have the mesosphere, and that's from that 31 mile-ish mark up to about 53 miles high. And then we have the thermosphere, which is from the top of the mesosphere, about 53 miles to, depending on who you ask to, something like 400 miles above the earth, after which you are getting into, some people say there's a fifth layer, but effectively at that point you're working your way into outer space, right? Beyond the atmosphere you get into outer space containing the moon, the planets, the stars, the sun, whatever else might be out there. And that's what we would consider to be the known universe, right? And before we move past this, before we move past the known universe thing, I want to make one more statement as it relates to this. One statement about those who genuinely question this knowledge. We live in a time where the word science is both severely strained and deeply overused. Everything is science. Everything that, if you don't agree with someone, you're denying the science. You're a science denier. Science has always been regarded as the process of seeking truth. As it relates to the things in our observable universe, we would call that natural science. Seeking truth as it relates to the way that God has designed the world that is around us. So that we could call something true or fact or a law when it is 100% observable, testable, and repeatable. Every time you test gravity, it does the same thing. That's why we call it the law of gravity. because it does the same thing every time. And we can talk about, are you closer to the equator? Are you farther away from the equator? All of the different things that affect gravity, gravitational pull. But those also conform to the known laws of physics, right? And so we have these things called laws, and then that binds us to a measure of truth. These things are consistent, and we know that they're consistent because they're designed, right? Because they are bound to the laws of the moral universe that God put into place when he said, let there be light, and indeed there was light. But as the scientific community of the 19th and 20th centuries began to cast off God, we've talked a little bit about that trifecta of humanism, Darwinian evolution, Karl Marx and Marxism, Sigmund Freud and Freudian psychology. As this trifecta came into being that stripped from that stripped away the need, quote unquote, for God in society in order to explain what had always been explained by God himself, the scientific community came to a conundrum where modernism gave way to postmodernism. The idea that truth exists gave way to there is not even such thing as truth. And how do you then conduct science? How do you then study the natural world and find in it absolute consistency and complete clarity when in fact you don't even believe that truth exists anymore? And so science went down a path of what we could call that the idea of natural science, scientists. Science is still what science is, right? Science is still the seeking of truth. It's just not exercised anymore. But the scientists, humanistic scientists, went down a path effectively of self-destruction, whereby to whatever extent they were willing to acknowledge the design of God in this world, they were able to harness that design to do amazing things, such as build cars and planes and rockets and computers. But only they could only do that if they acknowledged that the laws of the universe and the laws of physics existed. But then for the things that they could not see, they would cast off those laws and live in the realm of no truth at all. And so absolute truth began to be viewed as an impossibility and even evil. And the scientific community got on board with this because they said, well, yeah, things that we thought were absolute true 500 years ago are now not true anymore. And so they say, see, truth changes. Well, no, truth doesn't change. Humanity just discovered new information. So today when people say something is true, they don't mean that it's universally applicable and relevant. Rather, what they mean when they say today something is true is that their perceptions, experiences, desires, maybe their advantages, incline them in a direction, and that they've embraced those ideas because it inclines toward their feelings or their perceptions or their experiences or their desires. So that something can be true for you and not for me. And historically, something that has been true for you but not for me has been called an opinion, not a fact. With the word truth being reserved for those things which apply to everyone at all times because they are observable, testable, repeatable, consistent, and universal. But now in a postmodern mindset that rejects truth, opinion, what is now often termed my truth or my lived experience, is embraced as a valid foundation for a person to build upon their entire perception of reality. And now it's getting to the point where society is demanding that a person's lived experience not only dictate their reality, but dictate your reality too. Which means nobody lives in reality, which means nothing makes sense anymore. Now, I say all of this, and this does speak in large part to why our society is in such a mess today. But this shift in concepts of what we would call science, natural science, observable science, whereby things which are not testable, not repeatable, and not provable have become standard. Things such as Darwinian evolution, things such as dark matter, things such as global warming, things such as the genetic propensities of sodomites and transgender people. Transgenderites? I don't know. Whatever. These claims which are made, which have absolutely no basis in anything testable, repeatable, observable. And yet they have been for generations now elevated as scientific fact. And what this has done to you and to me as a general rule is it has made the Christian world, among others, but Christians are a large portion of this, very skeptical of anything labeled science. And I don't blame you. And I don't blame me. And this is not necessarily a bad thing. But what this has also done is it has opened our minds to alternative theories about just about everything. And the democratization of information through the internet has meant that any person, any Joe Schmo in their basement, living in their mom's basement, with a webcam and an internet connection, can actually have a authoritative voice on matters of the day. Whether or not they ought to, they can. Now, combine this with the Bible's poetic license, as it speaks of the formation and the existence of the earth. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 22 says that God sits upon the circle of the earth. Matthew chapter 4, verse 8 says that the devil took Jesus up to see all the kingdoms of the world. He saw all the kingdoms of the world as the devil took him up. Psalm 91, verse 3 says that the earth is established and cannot be moved. Psalm 104, verse 5 says that God laid the foundation of the earth. 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 8 says that the world sits upon pillars. And the list goes on and on. And this has led some to believe that the idea that the earth is a sphere, kind of a sphere, it's not really a perfect sphere, but that the earth is a sphere that rotates upon an axis and revolves around the sun along with other planets, with moons and such. It has led some Christians to believe, and this is becoming more and more popular, that this is false. And it has been placed under the label of the flat earth theory, right? The idea that the earth is actually flat, that it is not a sphere, that it is laid on pillars, on a foundation, and that it does not move, it is immovable, as the poetic, as the Psalms say through the poetic license. And I remind you, be careful with poetry. Poetry is oftentimes not meant to be taken literally, right? That's kind of the genre of poetry all around. And we see these things, these lists that goes on, and it has led many Christians to these theories. And then you get these YouTube videos that have any number of compelling ideas that undergird them. And there's a good deal of previous years, a little bit more perhaps, but a good deal of momentum behind what we would call the flat earth theory. And I by no means say any of what I'm about to say to disrespect those that might carry these ideas or entertain these ideas as you try to take the Bible, read it, take it at face value, and apply it in a way that makes sense to you. But the flat earth theory is nonsense. It is scientific nonsense. There are very simple experiments that even lay people can do to prove that it's nonsense. And again, I don't say that to be disrespectful if you have an interest in that thing, but it is not scientific, mathematically, like using God's design. I'm not talking about science like science is called today. I'm not talking about the science that says we're going to make something up in our head, we're going to write a white paper about it, a bunch of people that agree with us are going to peer review it, and then we're going to put it out there for the world and say it's authoritative. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about when you do the math, when you write out numbers on a page, when you observe and test and repeat the things in the world, it is entirely consistent with a spherical earth. That is as we would expect it to be if you buy one of those globes and your children have fun spinning it around because they don't do anything else with it but spin it around. Now, as we think of this, the church at large has never believed that the earth was flat. And I need to make that very clear. The idea that the church has historically been flat earth or believed in a flat earth is not true. That was actually something that was laid at the feet of the church during the 19th century when there were a bunch of attacks against the anti-scientific nature of the church. What is true is that the Catholic Church was extremely resistant to heliocentrism. So Galileo proposed the idea, the Catholic Church and the Church and really the scientific community at large for a long time was what we call geocentric. What that meant is that the Earth was the center of the solar system, and for many, the Earth was the center of the known universe. And then everything effectively revolved around the Earth. You see the sun moving, you see the Earth not. But Galileo proposed what we call heliocentrism, that all of the planets actually rotated around a star, and that the star was what was central, and the Earth was, in fact, rotating and then, of course, revolving on its axis. Infamously, the Church opposed Galileo's heliocentrism. But going all the way back, even to the 2nd century AD, we have people in the Church on record agreeing with the primary claims that the Earth is a sphere. Now, beyond just Church history, observable, testable, and repeatable science has confirmed that there is a spherical Earth, that the structure of the universe for generations as we've understood it now is correct. In order to believe otherwise, and this is important too, you and I would have to believe. Now, we're in a conspiracy generation. Occam's razor has been thrown out the window. Occam's razor says if there's a simple explanation, that's most likely the right explanation, right? Nowadays, we believe that people are so well connected and intertwined, and people can plan things so well that a little cabal of people can run the entire world and no one will catch on. We're in a conspiracy generation, and of course, it doesn't help that a lot of the things that were called conspiracy 20 years ago are coming to pass. But imagine how epic a conspiracy would have to be to keep everyone quiet who ever supposedly interacted with the Earth outside of being on the ground. We're talking astronauts, airline pilots, astronomers, people who build space vehicles and technology, people, the hundreds or thousands of companies that build satellites, that launch satellites, that use satellites, television companies, internet companies, every company, right? Hundreds of independent companies, people from nations and cultures all around the world, without anybody throwing up a little yellow flag and saying, hey, there's something weird going on with the math that I'm doing. Even soldiers, snipers, have to take the curvature of the Earth into account when they take a long shot. It's called the Coriolis effect. Imagine all of those people deciding to keep their mouth shut. For not just for 1 year or for one generation, but for generations. And it doesn't really add up. And again, that's why I call it nonsense. But if you have questions about this, you can certainly come and see me. I'm not a scientist per se, but as I said, there are relatively simple math and science experiments which can be done to validate a spherical Earth. And while we all need to be skeptical in this age of experts, this age of copious misinformation, we also need to be careful that we don't allow the fact that we should rightly mistrust many things about what's out there today to cause us to mistrust everything. And we should not necessarily allow the fact that many people who are so-called experts are absolutely bankrupt of any sort of knowledge or any sort of capacity to speak on the topics of which they're speaking to mean that there are not people who we can go to and trust their integrity as well as trust the math. So if you want to learn more about that, once again, I reference you to any creation science website. And if you go to any reputable, I should probably, there's a lot of websites out there. The ones that I have listed, Institute of Creation Research, creation.com, Answers in Genesis, go there, type in flat earth. These scientists will give you the math if you don't want to do it yourself. They will show you the experiments if you don't want to do them yourself. And you will be able to see that people who love the Lord, people who believe the Bible, people who believe in a young earth, people who have rejected the expert consensus as it relates to so-called science and pseudoscience today, if they're going to have any ability to actually functionally do astronomy, they have to account for a spherical earth, for a heliocentric model for these things. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that per se. Forgive the aside, but I feel it's important to mention because that is something that is finding its way into a lot of Christian circles today, and it should not be. Back into our context. Within our understanding of the observable universe, We have the earth, we have its atmosphere, and we have outer space. Coming back to this, right? And I did need to say that because in a flat earth model, this is not how they see it. Okay? We have outer space. And the Bible, the question we need to ask then is, okay, so we have between the waters and the waters, heaven. What is heaven speaking of? And we'll use our larger context to answer this. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 9, the Bible says, "And God said, let the waters under heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so." So we know that the heaven was above the lower seas, which verse 7 already told us, and that out of those lower seas came dry land, which means that the heaven is above the dry land upon which we stand today in terms of material space. So it's above what we now know as the earth. The next occurrence we find in Genesis 1:14. "And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years." Okay, so now we're getting somewhere, right? God placed the lights in the firmament of the heaven. So that would be the open space that is the heaven. That's what this is saying here. And he put those lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide day and night, and to be for signs, for seasons, for days, for years. We'll come back to this when I preach on verse 4. Or day 4, not verse 4, day 4. But we understand that these lights are the sun, which is the nearest star to us, the moon, and the distant stars, planets presumably as well. These are described as being in the firmament or the open space of the heaven. So that means we know that outer space is included in this label of the firmament of the heaven. Let's keep reading and allow the Bible to keep defining. Genesis 1:20 says this, "And God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and the fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven." So now we find that God had also established the birds would fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. With a few extremely rare exceptions, birds fly almost exclusively within that first layer of the atmosphere that we call the troposphere, that first 6 miles of atmosphere. So then the heaven, as it's defined in Genesis 1 itself, includes outer space and Earth's atmosphere. Okay, so now we have the biblical definition of the firmament, which is called heaven, as the Bible establishes it in Genesis chapter 1 for the sake of creation. Again, we're not talking about the fact that later the Bible will say that God dwells in the heaven and the place that is his throne room. That's a different context. That's added later. That is not within the context of what we find here. What we find here is the heaven is defined in Genesis 1:14 and 1:20 as two things, outer space and the Earth's atmosphere. So now we have this definition. And the waters which were below the firmament were upon the earth. So what about the waters which were above the firmament? Well, there are innumerable theories about this. Many rational and logical theories equate this water to perhaps an extremely dense cloud cover, which God then thinned some at some point, probably after the flood, because it had not rained on the earth until the days of the flood. Others believe that there would be a water canopy that would envelop the earth. And these all have very interesting implications specifically for that pre-flood time, because we ask the questions, why did they live so long? What was it about the earth that made them live to be 900 years old? Why was it that after the flood, in a matter of a couple of generations, they go from living to be 900 to 120? What happened? What changed? And so you say, well, if there was an intense cloud cover, or if there was a water layer or something like that, then it might filter out the UV light, which would mean that the cells would not be disintegrating as fast and would not be damaged as much because the UV light is filtered. If you ever, underwater, if you ever look at like fish and octopodes, that's official, octopodes, and those sorts of things, it's true, octopus, octopode. Look it up. If you look at those animals, they don't have eyelids because they don't need to deal with the problems of UV light because the water filters that out, right? And so we see all of these things, and there are all of these theories, and each one is interesting and has merit in one way or another. But the problem, as I study the text, is that the place where God puts the sun, moon, and the stars is still below the waters. the firmament. It's in the firmament, and God divided the waters from the waters and put the firmament in between. And to that end, I don't know of any theory that places the waters simply above the earth's atmosphere is sufficient to explain what Genesis is describing. It's simple enough, then, to say that these waters are at the edge of the material universe. There's one guy I was reading, and there's a lot of very interesting theories, who talked about there's an ice belt beyond Neptune. There's like a 400-mile ice belt. No, 400, not mile, 400 astronomical unit, which is like millions of miles. But a 400 astronomical unit ice belt. And he was saying maybe that's the water of the firmament, except that that's only in our solar system. That's not the known universe, unless what we know about the known universe is incorrect, which is certainly possible. But all of that to say, what we can say is this. It would seem as though the waters were at the edge, or are at the edge, of the material universe, the edge of matter. And that would make perfect biblical and consistent sense, so that as God stretched out the heavens in order to make more space for the celestial bodies at the in the universe, the end of said universe is, or was, perhaps, is water. And there are, of course, many other theories. As I said, if you go to creation science journals, read various journals, people have, lots of scientists have wondered about this. For our purposes, however, we can confidently define heaven as ranging from Earth's atmosphere into the expanse of outer space, and everything that was there was created in the second day, and the evening and the morning were the second day. We continue day three. Bible says in verses 9 through 13, "And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass and herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the third day." So in this third day, the Bible says that God gathered the waters together. He allowed dry land to come up, to appear from those waters. So the earth now has dry land. And upon this dry land, God puts plants of all sorts. Specifically, he mentions grass, herb-yielding seed, and fruit trees. God saw that it was good. We see here, however, something that he institutes with the plants, and that is that everything began to reproduce after its kind. In this case, we simply have the seeds, that when the seeds, the herb-yielding seed, that those seeds would then bring about plants that were after their own kind. And this is a part of what we would understand God established on day one, on that first day. Let there be light, and there was light. As he established the moral universe, he established this idea that everything is going to reproduce after its kind. This is a part of God's design. Which means you're never going to put a corn kernel into the ground and you're going to find watermelon when it grows. You're not going to plant apple trees and find orange trees. Now, you might find that if someone got the seeds mixed up, right, in the packet, or you might find some sort of weird hybridization going on among plants that can cross-pollinate. I know we grew a lot of cantermelons growing up. Cantaloupe and watermelon kind of looked like a cantaloupe, but inside it had watermelon in it. So those things can happen. There can be cross-pollination among various similar kinds. But everything reproduces after its kind, and we see that here. The evening and the morning were the third day. Verses 14 through 19. "And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night. And let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And he made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light upon the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day. So on the fourth day, God put lights in the sky. I spent quite a bit of time in that lesson on day one talking about the lights in the sky and the differences between them. So I'm not going to get back into that again. But do note that God's purpose for these lights in the sky is stated here in verses 14 and 15 as being for signs, for seasons, for days, for years. So once again, we find God establishing a means by which, first, for him to communicate, and second, by which for man to keep time. And he also made that provision for seasons, which we won't see perhaps into full effect until after the flood. We know that God has always used specifically the stars as a method of signs. We see that in Messiah's day, right? We'll be coming up here on Christmas soon, and we'll be talking a lot about the star that the wise men saw, that whereby they knew that Messiah had been born, that there had been a king born, and that is the idea here as it relates to signs. And then verse 15 also naturally emphasizes that the lights would give light upon the earth, the sun to rule the day and the moon to rule the night as a reflection of the sun's light, a much lesser light in the night. And then, of course, it says he made the stars also. Now, Genesis is not being dismissive here, and I don't have a problem. Many pastors or I've heard many sermons where they say, and it was such a, you know, amazing thing that, you know, the Bible even says, oh, and he made the stars too. And they're so grand, and yet they were just an afterthought. Not really the idea or the implication of this. The implication is that the stars didn't really have anything to do with giving light to the earth. I mean, they're little lights in the sky at night, but they don't provide light for man, and so they were not the focal point of what was being said there in the text, which is why they're not focused there. And the Bible says that God saw it all, and it was good, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day. Verses 20 to 23, we have the fifth day, and God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creatures that hath life, and the fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the water brought forth abundantly after their kind. There it is again, after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good, and God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let the fowl multiply in the earth. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. So on day five, God populates the seas with sea creatures and the heaven with winged creatures, both after their kind. And we find for the first time that there is an obvious distinction given between something and plant life. And this would be that these creatures, these unique creatures, they don't just have seeds and thus reproduce after their kind in that way. But God actually blessed these creatures and told them, be fruitful and multiply. This process by which these creatures, which are more sentient beings, are going to reproduce after their kind. And the sea creatures will fill the seas, and the birds will fill the earth. Of course, they fly in the heaven, but they live on the earth, and they would multiply. And so we see God's design. Not just for the idea of plants reproducing seeds, bearing seeds that then fall to the ground and bear more plants, but animals reproducing after their kind. And this leads us to day six. Genesis 1, 24 through 31. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth after his kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed, which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which the fruit of a tree yielding seed, in which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed. And you shall, and to you it shall be for meat. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life. I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. And God saw everything he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. Okay, so I already told you that, though I just read it, we are skipping the element of mankind. We'll talk next week. We'll preach on verses 26 through 29. But apart from that, on the sixth day, God makes the land creatures after their kind, and he sees that they are good. Picking up in verse 30, God gives every beast, fowl, creeping thing to eat plants, the plants that he made on day three. He says that they will be meat for them. That word meat in our King James is simply the word for food. It doesn't mean meat as we think of it today, which would be flesh. When the King James wants to talk about flesh, it uses the word flesh. When it uses the word meat, it's speaking of things to eat. And that's consistent. That's consistent. So when we see, when you see the meat offerings in the law, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's flesh. Those could be grains as well. Those could be different things other than just flesh, because the word meat in our King James Bible does not mean flesh. And so God gave all of the plants to be meat for the beasts and the fowl and the creeping things. And what we find here, now we've already talked about the fact that everything is reproducing after its kind. This is a direct affront to Darwinian evolution, right? Which says that a kind can become a physically different kind. That a bird can become a, or that a dinosaur can become a bird. A reptile can become a bird, right? That a fish can become a reptile, then a reptile can become a bird, then a bird can become, you know, whatever. And it goes on, right? And you know, monkeys become people and all of this. That is not what the Bible teaches. Now, you can believe it, but you can't find it in the Bible. You can believe it, but you cannot impose it on Genesis 1. Because in Genesis 1, it says that God made everything to reproduce after its kind. So don't try to play that game. Right? We must not play that game. You cannot shoehorn changing kinds that they reproduce against their kind or alter their kind into a Bible that says God made them to reproduce after their kind. Choose one. And we choose to believe the Bible. Second, we find here that God gave to every animal meat to eat of the plants. So that we find that there was no, the animals were not eating other animals. Well, let me ask you this. If the 6 days of creation are trying to bring about some sort of Darwinian evolution idea, Darwinian evolution is based upon a fundamental principle called survival of the fittest. And in that survival of the fittest, the weak die out and the strong survive. The Bible tells us that there was no death until sin. And if there's no death till sin, and sin has not yet entered the system through man, we'll talk about that next week, because man was given dominion, then there should be no death. So if there's no death yet, and there's no killing yet, then there is no Darwinian evolution in Genesis 1. Not only do you not see it naturally, but you can't even put it there. It doesn't fit. It just does not fit. Death had not yet come into the system. There was no killing. There was no survival of the fittest. No animals were killing each other. Nothing was eating them. And so God saw everything that he had made, and this is an important thing too. If these 6 days had been built on the death of creatures and on survival of the fittest, and God saw everything that he made in those 6 days, which might analogously be, whatever, millions of years, and God saw everything he made and it was good, could it be called good if it had come about through a process of Darwinian evolution? If man was the what was the final evolved form based upon millions and millions and millions of years of the evolution of various first quadrupeds that became bipeds that then evolved and their brains evolved and they became more self-aware and all of those elements into what we were. And yet when God called them Adam and Eve, these are those fully formed man and woman. That is the species that we understand today as Homo sapien. And God saw those fully formed Adam and Eve, and God saw the elephants and the birds that came from the dinosaurs or the reptiles, that came from the fish and all of the death and all of the destruction and all of that, and all of the dysfunction of animals being born without essential parts that would allow it to survive properly until they somehow, after they were dead, decided to evolve those parts that they would need to live. And all of that, and you get that whole process, and then God looked at it and said, that is good. Not my God. Not the God the Bible teaches about. God sent Jesus to undo all of that junk, to undo all the death, to undo all of the destruction, to undo all of the sorrow, to undo when somebody is born and they have malfunctioning parts of their body, when their arms don't work or their legs don't work or their brain isn't functioning properly or their eyes don't work or their ears don't work. And we feel naturally sympathy for those who are in these fundamental ways handicapped from being able to have that fullness of the human experience in one way, shape, or form because of a deficiency which was no fault of their own. And we think of those things and we recognize that Christ came to undo the effects of sin, to undo the effects of death, to undo the effects of deterioration. But if those effects were a part of what God said is good, then God has no moral authority to undo them. But God saw it, and it was good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. And this brings us to the end of our time together today. And while, again, this was quite teachy, with little to take away as far as natural application, as far as I'm concerned, per se, unless you have been questioning some of these things, I do want to encourage you in one more thing. That as I thought through this, and as I was putting this together and thinking about God and the created universe, and I've had conversations with various people at various times when Greg would take us up to Canada and we'd be up there looking at the nature that is around us, and we'd talk about how beautiful it is and still and it is pristine and untouched. And Greg and I would talk about the fact that this is the fallen world, right? This is. This beauty and this creation and this wonder, driving to and from Little Falls yesterday and seeing all of the trees, and in the morning, it was when we were going up there, the fog, there was a fog over the waters, and it was so beautiful. And you see all of that beauty and you say, and this is the fallen world. Imagine what it must have looked like on day six. And you look at the creation around you, and that's what I want to encourage you. You know, Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4 says, when I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, the psalmist writing about to God here, what is man that thou art mindful of him? And the son of man that thou visitest him? How small we are in the scheme of so much grandeur and beauty, and yet God loves us. Psalm 19, verses 1 through 6, to the chief musician, a psalm of David. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where there, that would be creation's voice, is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them hath he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoiceth as a strong man to run a race. His going forth is from the end of the heaven, and his circuit unto the ends of it. And there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. There is no speech or language where the voice of creation is not heard and does not testify of God. And if Romans 1 is to be believed, and it is, not just of God's existence, but of God's eternal power and Godhead. The firmament indeed shows his handiwork. And if I may encourage you, it's a wonderful time of year for this, to take some time, maybe today, maybe in the, over the next week, get up and enjoy a sunrise. Get out at night and view the heavens. Apparently last night was the aurora borealis. I kind of forgot about that. I missed it. I don't know if anyone saw it. It was supposed to be down this far last night. One of my favorite things this time of year is for me to look out my windows in the front and to see the lake. And as the earth is rotating, because we believe it does that, the sun hitting the far side of the lake while our house is still in the shadows, and watching those light the trees in the fall light up, all the yellows and the reds and the oranges, and light up. And don't just enjoy creation. I'm not just encouraging you to go out and hug a tree, but take a moment to contemplate the kind of God of which that creation testifies. Don't allow your familiarity with creation to breed contempt for the Creator. Allow creation to testify of the kind of God we serve. Think of His order. Think of His creativity. Think of His sense of humor. Think of His magnitude. Think of His majesty. These are things which God's fingerprints are reflective of in creation itself. And don't let that pass by. Because that's creation is a wonderful testimony of God, of who He is. And as Psalm 8 testifies, it's a wonderful way to remind us of our place. And also to remind us not just that we are small, but that we are still significant to God, though we are but so small. Thank God for it. And may we learn through God's creation to glorify the God that we serve.
Thank you for listening to Pastor Jamin Wickler from Legacy Baptist Church in Buffalo, Minnesota. More information about Legacy Baptist Church and a library of sermons are available at www.legacybaptistchurch.net.